Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following the Gospel of Mark, and today we're going to do Mark chapter 10, verses 35 to 45. And there's a very interesting turn in this gospel about the whole nature of authority and the whole purpose of authority and the whole relationship of ourselves to the Lord as the suffering servant, who our Lord is the one who came for others. And it's the gospel in Mark's version of when James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come to Jesus and say, "Master, we have a favor. We want you to do a favor for us." And Jesus says to them, "Well, what is it that you want me to do?" And they said to him, "Allow us to sit one at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory." So once again, even James and John, part of the triumvirate, part of the three, along with Peter, who seemed to be the closest to the Lord, seemed to be the ones that he picks out of the group of apostles to take with him, for instance, when he goes up to the mountain to pray and the transfiguration takes place. And he pulls them aside in other events within the Gospels as well. And yet, at the same time, despite his teaching and despite his example, they are still very much caught up in the Hebrew concept of who the Messiah is going to be. We've seen this before, and we've seen this kind of as the reason for what they call the messianic secret, when Jesus does something and says, "Don't tell anyone about it." And the whole purpose of that, the whole reason for that, is because if you say, "Well, we have found the Messiah," then the people are not going to say, "Well, let us come and see who he is and what he's going to do." They're going to say, "Oh, I already have an idea in my mind of who the Messiah is, and so I'm going to come to the Messiah and with my expectations," which they do from time to time. And then when he doesn't fulfill those expectations, they walk away, they turn away from him. And so here, James and John are caught up in the very same thing. We've seen so often, what was it that the Hebrew people expected the Messiah to be? The most general expectations, if they did believe in the coming of a Messiah, was a great king like David or a great general, somebody that would lead Israel to great triumphs. Remember that they are living in the aftermath of the empire of Alexander the Great, and that this whole idea of what it means to be great and powerful and all those kinds of things usually is interpreted in a political realm, in a political understanding, and so great generals and so forth. There was, of course, the Essene expectations, which creep into particularly the letter to the Hebrews, as the letter to the Hebrews intends to respond to the Essene expectations of the Lord. But they do. There are some of them then that see the teacher of light and the teacher of righteousness and so forth, a great prophet, a great teacher. But the majority of the ordinary people, it was something much different. They tied it up with the greatness of Israel, with the greatness of Israel as an international power, an international entity to be dealt with, and especially now that they were under the heel of the Roman Empire during the life of Jesus, somehow or other this expectation to throw off the yoke of the Roman Empire and to be a great empire on their own, all this kind of thing. So that when James and John approach the Lord, they approach him out of this milieu, and they say, "Allow us to sit one at your right hand and the other at your left in your glory." Well, that can mean any number of things. It can mean that they expected a great earthly kingdom, or it could be that they expected, you know, some kind of glorious heavenly manifestation of the power and the kingdom of the Lord. Whatever it is, Jesus looks at them not in anger at all, because this is a normal human thing, to want to be important, to want to have power, to want to be somehow or other, I don't know what we call it. Maybe have our existence justified by great achievements or something. But whatever it was, Jesus looks at them and says, "You do not know what you're asking." And this is where the real tone of who the Messiah truly is starts to come through, because Jesus fails in the expectations of Israel. Jesus fails to do what they want him to do, because he comes in a very different way, for a very different reason, a very different purpose. And he says to him, "Can you drink the cup that I must drink, or be baptized with the baptism with which I must be baptized?" This is a common way of saying, can you share my fate? Can you share my destiny? Will you follow me wherever I go? Because I know that this is not going to end the way you want it to end, at least not for the time being. And so they said, yes, of course we can. And then Jesus says, well, the cup that I must drink, you shall drink, and with the baptism with which I must be baptized, you shall be baptized. But as for seats at my right hand and my left, these are not mine to grant. They belong to those who, with whom they have been allotted. So basically he's saying, you know, he knows them. And he knows that this is human foible that they're involved in right now. He knows when push comes to shove, when the real times come, that they are going to be faithful to him. James is going to ultimately be beheaded by Herod Agrippa about the year 44 AD. John apparently is not martyred. He lives to great old age, but he lives so in persecution, in exile, and so forth. And so he does, he suffers. Of all the apostles, most of them are martyred. All of them, I think, are martyred except John. But John, there is a certain martyrdom in living to old age in a time of persecution, in a time of chaos. It is a great burden, and maybe beheading would be more merciful at times. But at any rate, he does say to them, yeah, you are going to experience this. Yes, you are going to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized, and you are going to drink of the cup that I drink. But really and honestly, you don't even know what that is right now. So you don't even know what you're asking for right now. And then he says, but as for sitting at my right hand and my left hand, that's for those that's not mine to give. That's not the incarnate Christ. That's the will of the divine that in some way, shape, or form, in conjunction with the incarnate Son of God, works out in a way, in a strange sort of way, because this is something that's very, very important when we deal with Scripture. We are very used to, when we deal with the question of time, we are very, very used to dealing with kind of a Renaissance notion of time, a time when rationalism entered into the Western world, into Western thought, somewhere around the 12th, 13th century, and which progressed up through the Enlightenment and then into the scientific, mechanistic scientific revolution of Newton and so forth. And finally is fading back into a more realistic kind of thing in the chaos of the modern age. But time in the Renaissance was taken as a measurement, and that's what most of us think of it as. It is a measurement of duration. It is a rational linear line. No one can say, well, I'm going to go back into the past and do this, that, or the other thing. Or no one can say, well, I mean, we had the great movie Back to the Future, but no one's going to say, well, we can move into the future and so forth. So we realize that the present is the entity, the created entity in which most of us experience the now. But all of us have experienced the past because we have all lived in the past. In Scripture, time is not a rational, linear measurement of duration. Time is a created entity that exists as long as creation exists. It does not flow away. It does not come into being. It is, which means that the past and the present and the future are always somehow already existent in time. And that this is why, for instance, in the Old Testament, you are never permitted to go to a fortune teller, or when Saul went to the witch of Endor to conjure up Samuel to tell him his destiny, his fate, And this was considered to be a grave violation of the trust in God, because part of our not knowing the future is that we do trust in the living God to care for us to the very end of our lives. But if without being able in some way to revisit the past that does still exist in this created entity of time, we could not have the sacramental life of the church. We couldn't especially have the Eucharist. This is not a community celebration where we all get together and, you know, and share a remembrance of Jesus Christ or something. This is where we become present to Jesus Christ. In his life, death, and resurrection, we have become present to the means of our salvation and redemption, and we do so through word and through ritual, exactly as they did become present to the past in the Old Testament, in the Passover, the Feast of First Fruits, and so forth. So as we come to understand this, and even in contemporary philosophy, it's really interesting. There's a philosopher from the University of Toronto named Kevin Schmitz, and he, as a philosopher of time, really comes to the biblical understanding of time. The time is always past, present, and future. It is a coming to be and a passing away, but the passing away never is not, nor is the coming to be not in existence, and so forth. It's a complicated problem, but the problem is that time itself exists. It is not a measuring stick. It is something that does exist. So that when Jesus says that they belong to those to whom they have been allotted, it means that in some way, shape, or form, that future already is. And that that the present is not going to alter or change that future in some sort of way. It's not a question of predestination. And it's not back to that ghastly argument about the freedom of man in the 17th century with the idea of grace as being foreknowledge or physical premotion or anything like that. It's a question of time is. And so something has already been that we have not yet experienced, or something already is that we have not yet experienced and entered into that experience. So that Jesus is not talking about somehow or other taking away the freedom or any kind of thing like that. He's talking in the terms of a first century Hebrew who has a different notion, a different understanding of time than you and I do. And I think when we read the scriptures and we read this, we have to be careful. I'm always kind of bemused by the fact in all sorts of, at least it used to be, I haven't been in one a long time, but in a CCD room or PSR room or whatever we call religious education today in the parishes and schools, that you always had kind of the time charts around. Those are very helpful because they help us to, in some way, orient our minds to the past. Nevertheless, they do portray that idea that it's kind of a measurement of time. And if we get too deeply into that rational measurement of time, we become incapable of dealing really with the sacramental life of the church. So we have to stay in some way attuned to the biblical sense when we're reading the Gospels at all, because we have to understand that we cannot superimpose our notion of time upon first century, nor can we impose it upon the whole order of creation. It is a particular perspective in time which is useful to us, but which is not by any way, shape, or form the whole story at all. So that then he is reminding them that that's not theirs to choose, and that's not something that they can jockey for. This is not kind of a political campaign to be at the right and at the left. That these are things left to destiny, left to the future, left to the knowing hands of the Creator. When the other 10 heard this, they were indignant with James and John. And so Jesus called them together and said to them, and this is interesting, you know that among the pagans, their so-called rulers lord it over them, and their great men make their authority felt. How much do we know that in the church and in secular society as well? The idea of the misuse of authority, of the misunderstanding of authority, is rampant in both church and secular society. But Jesus says to them, this is not to happen to you. Anyone who wants to become great among you must be your servant, and anyone who wants to be first among you must be a slave to all. He uses here two words, one meaning deacon and one meaning as servant, as the one who serves, and one being slave, which I think is the word doulos, which is also used in some of Paul's letters also. Slave not being in some way, shape, or form some kind of denigrated human being, but someone who gives and lives for the sake of the other, for the sake of another. And that becomes the whole idea for him of what authority is. And I think that we have seen in the past, this is why, for instance, papal authority is so interesting. I think that it was long in the past that Pope Leo the Great said that we are unworthy heirs, that the popes were unworthy heirs of St. Peter. They had the obligation of authority, but they did not have the personal qualifications to use that authority in the true sense of the real apostle. And by that, I mean a personal identification with the Prince of the Apostles, with Peter himself. They have his office and they have his authority, but they do not have his personhood. And I think that is why, for instance, the popes were called the servants of the servant of God. I'm not sure whether that was Leo the Great or Gregory the Great. I really think it was Leo the Great who, in this idea of the unworthy servant, was unworthy heirs, becomes also the servant of the servants of God. That's a gospel concept and one that is very deeply. He is not to lord it over others. He is to exercise authority for the well-being of the whole church, the well-being of the whole community. We have this all the time that happens, and we've seen the abuse of this in the hierarchy of the church through the ages. We've seen it in government. We've seen it in courtrooms. We've seen it everywhere, where people take the authority of their office, which is instituted for the service of others, and they accrue it to themselves as a personal prerogative. And in so doing, they always misuse it. No one can take the authority given to them from God, accrue it to themselves as a personal characteristic, a personal quality, a personal possession, and not misuse it. We see, of course, you know, in the dialogue between Jesus and Pontius Pilate, when Pilate says to Jesus, "Don't you know I have authority over you?" And he said, "You have no authority whatsoever if it were not given to you from my Father." In other words, it is not your personal possession. Authority exists as the presence and the exercise of the divine within the world through the medium of human persons. I think that we have seen that used beautifully in the papacy for many centuries, and we've seen it also in some of the better world leaders from time to time. But we have also seen the worst of it, where they take it to themselves as a personal possession and they use it as a weapon against their dissenters, those who disagree with them. The servant of the servants of God, the ones who exercises diakonia within the community, the one who is the slave to all, not in the denigrating, demeaning sense of the word, but one who lives for the sake of others. This is what it means to have authority, especially in the church. But it also, as Jesus indicates to Pontius Pilate, it's also the exercise of authority, of civil authority. And I think that when we find, for instance, that the wickedness that goes with power, we hear the old thing, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Historically, that's probably a pretty fair axiom to have. There's always exceptions. There are always exceptions. And that's why in the history of the church has canonized oftentimes kings and queens, not because to curry favor with the ruling class, but because those who really exemplify this living for the sake of others, exercising their office for the sake of those whom they are sent to serve, they are pulled out and recognized and set up as a model. We find that, for instance, in St. Henry. We find it in St. Margaret of Scotland. We find it in St. Elizabeth of Thuringia. or hungry. We find it in Louis de France. We find it in the exercise of authority of Los Reyes Católicos, Ferdinand and Isabella in Spain. We see people using their authority for the well-being of the community, not as a personal weapon, not as a personal possession that they have, which they can do with whatever they please and let the chips fall where they may. That's not exactly what this is all about. And this is not what Jesus is talking. Jesus says this is how the pagans exercise authority. They don't exercise authority as service to others. They exercise authority as somehow or other a personal possession that they can use against others. Certainly we saw that in the Third Reich. Certainly we saw that in the Soviet Union. Certainly we saw that in the Maoist Revolution in China. Certainly we saw it with Robert Mugabe in Africa, and we see it also. We saw it with Juan Perón in Argentina. We have seen it over and over again throughout the world. This idea that somehow or other this is a personal privilege, a personal possession of mine. And we know that that simply is not the case. We see, for instance, in the even in the papacy back in the Renaissance and in the 16th century, the popes using their personal authority for personal gain, for family, for themselves, for the use of other people and so forth. And we find that to be a great crisis in the church when a pope does not understand the nature of his own authority. And it was the same way with civil rulers. So Jesus is telling the apostles, this is not your mission, and this is not your destiny. You are not going to be the ones who somehow or other, sitting on my right and left, exercise absolute authority over anybody else. And in order for the apostles really to deeply understand what it means to serve others completely, each of them gave their life for the sake of the Lord, the God whom they served, and for the sake of the people whom they were sent to. So that martyrdom became, in some ways, kind of the sign of the perfect ruler, the one who was willing to give up their life for the service that they owed to their Lord and the service that they owed to their people. And they knew and they understood that their witness was very, very powerful for the people that they led, because they wanted to demonstrate and to show in some way, shape, or form what the proper disposition is, first of all, in our relationship between earth and heaven, our relationship between God and the powers of the world. And they wanted to make sure that we understood and that we saw clearly that in some way, shape, or form, that authority, position of any kind, and this goes from parents and families to teachers in classrooms. We find abusive parents who are in some way, shape, or form taking their parental authority as an absolute possession for themselves. We see teachers do the same thing. We find professors indoctrinating students, not trying to draw the goodness out of the student, not trying to share human wisdom of some kind, but to indoctrinate and make them automatons for ideologies within the world. And we see this, and we see it in the church. We see bishops who have abused their power and so forth and used it for their own gain and not in any way for the good of the church. So we know what the Lord is talking about, and it's kind of a powerful thing that he says to them. And he says, remember, when you are baptized with the baptism with which I was baptized, when you drink the cup out of which I drank, then you will come to know and to understand what it is to sit at my right and sit at my left. Then you will know what it is to exercise authority under the authority of the divine and in the midst of the community whom you are sent to serve. For then he said, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So he came into the world not to be the glorious king that people would come to, but to be the one who in love for his people gives his life for them. That is the ultimate exercise of authority, to give life for the people you serve for the greater honor and glory of God, and for, as a sign of your love for them, your care for them, the authenticity of your authority over them. And then he said he gave his life as a ransom for many. A ransom not to mean in this old juridical Anselmian sense of somehow or other the father demanded the life of the son in order that justice could be satisfied. But ransom for the sake, in the same way he talked about ransoming the people from Israel and so forth, it's a way of saving them through love. It's a way of saving them through giving his life and his grace and his wisdom and his knowledge and his care and his presence for them, and gave for the many. A very controversial word in the contemporary church, this idea of the many, because when it was put into the Eucharistic prayer, there was all sorts of consternation about it. But in Isaiah 53, it says he came to give his life for the many. It is not an exclusive many. It is more like multitude. It is more like the many. It is an inclusive term, and it does not have parameters to it. It could mean all, and it could mean only some, but it doesn't mean that in itself in either direction. It simply means the great multitude, and we might be able to say in a more vernacular way, perhaps all is a better translation, but it's not the biblical term. It's not the way the Bible uses the term. And he makes it very clear in Isaiah and now here that it is for the many. And that is what appears in the Gospels. So controversial as it is, we all, in our own minds, for our own sake, ought to think of it somehow or other as a non-exclusive term, whatever the parameters of it might be. So in this, then, here we have the story. Human nature desiring something great for itself, something wonderful for itself, has the humility at least to ask God for it and not just to usurp it or take it. And God teaches them a serious lesson about it. It will come to you probably, but with a cost. Are you willing to pay the price for the gifts that you ask? We ought to always ask that in our lives. For our gifts, prayers for healing, for our prayers for reconciliation, all those things, will we pay the price that it costs us to do that? A valid question when we petition the Lord for favors. And then when he says, yes, I know you will, for you are faithful disciples and you are good men, and you will come to me. But for the time being, just kind of understand that this is not about power, but this is about giving of yourselves for the sake of others, as certainly you will do, and as certainly as history lets us know, they did.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com. Veni,